You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Jemima Houston talking wā no mai hare mai ki te wā mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rahina Monday, the 30th of August. I'm your host, Jemima. I'm here with you today because we're still in level 4 lockdown and I am taking over from, I'm looking after the show for Jessica and Louis, who have produced the show from home, and I'll be with you for the next hour. As I said, our newsroom is working remotely at the moment, so I am the one that's in studio doing the show at the moment, but some awesome pieces have been created for today's show. So e whai akine, let's talk about it. Jessica speaks to Conversion Therapy Action Group on how people can have a say on the proposed legislation to ban harmful conversion therapy practices. She also speaks to Dr. Paula O'Kane from Otago Business School on how employers can best support their employees during lockdown. Louis then goes on to talk to author Mandy Hager about a new book, Aotearoa's History of Protest. He also speaks to the University of Otago's Professor Elizabeth Sluton and Sea Shepherd's Michael Laurie about the critically endangered Maui and Hector's dolphins. And then finally, Louis speaks to Dr. Kyle Clem from the Victoria University of Wellington on the impact of New Zealand weather on South America. That's what's coming up on the show today. If you are interested in sending through a text or giving me a call about any of the pieces on the show today, you can send me through a text on 5395, that's the number, or give me a call in studio, 309-3879. And then also after the show, ko we e wariwari e ahi ana koutou te whakarongo ki enei kōrero anō he pakihiri rokiroki maranga i te pae tukutuku o Irirangi Pōho, me haere ki 95 BFM Irakati. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website. Head to the BCasts page and then head to The Wire and you can check out all the pieces we've created over this last lockdown period. But we've got a pretty chocker show today, so we'll crack into it now, shall we?
Irirangi Pōho, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
There are 9 days left for people to make submissions to the Justice Select Committee to have their say on the proposed legislation to ban harmful conversion therapy practices. Conversion therapy has been discredited by the National Health Service and the World Psychiatric Association. Chanel Lal, co-founder of Conversion Therapy Action Group, says that there are currently more submissions against banning conversion therapy than there are for. This includes submissions from trans-exclusionary radical feminist groups. Jessica spoke to Chanel Lal about why it is important for allies, parents and the LGBTQIA plus community to make a submission. Here they are now.
There are a few steps before a bill can become a law. So the first reading, which we've already been through, then comes the select committee, then there's the second reading, third reading and the royal assent. So we are currently at the second reading stage and the bill to ban conversion practices has gone to the justice select committee. What happens there is that the justice select committee comes together and these are members of parliament. They come together and they try to amend the bill, and they can only amend the bill if we have our say, if we tell them what we want changed. Unfortunately, the queer community hasn't had an appropriate amount of time to have a say because we were given 2 less weeks than you would normally get. So we haven't been able to get all of our concerns in there. However, it is becoming increasingly important to have our says because the team that is against banning conversion therapy have been getting their submissions in quite a significant number.
So when we're looking at submissions and people making submissions, I think a misconception might be whether quality versus quantity matters. Mm. So is it more important that we get the numbers or that people's submissions have something that hasn't already been said?
I think quality is definitely important. It is one of those things that really tell the select committee that there is some sort of validity and credibility to our submissions. So it is important that we have quality submissions. However, the Justice Select Committee does report how many submissions they got in favor and how many they got in against. So while we may have a few quality submissions, if they get overwhelmingly significant numbers of submissions against banning conversion therapy, they will report to the House that majority of the people who submitted to the Justice Select Committee do not want conversion therapy banned. And that's where quantity becomes really important. We need to be able to put the government in a position where they can say, hey, majority of New Zealand told us that we want conversion therapy banned. But if they don't have that evidence, then they cannot say that. And then it becomes difficult for them to have that conversation. We know that this bill will pass because the Labour Party has a majority in Parliament and that's all they need. However, it is important that we pass the right bill.
When you're talking about the right bill, there's been some areas identified by the community that they would like to be improved on. Are people able to discuss their views on this in the bill? I'm sorry, in their submissions without it taking away from their support of it.
Yep, absolutely. So the select committee happens in two steps. So one step is giving a general support, and that's where you talk about why you want this to end and why do you support it. And the second part is where you write what you want to change about the bill. So absolutely, people are able to say that I support this and this is why I support it, but these are the things that I want to change about the bill. And I think that's the crucial part, that we tell them what we want to see changed in the bill.
And you mentioned that this bill will pass because the Labour government has the majority, but what are some of the consequences that could happen if we receive more submissions against banning conversion therapy than for?
I think one of the very obvious consequences of receiving a lot of submissions against banning conversion therapy is that it makes a lot of exemptions for people. So we know that the National Party on the Justice Select Committee are advocating to create exemptions for parents to continue practicing conversion practices. What I also know is that TERF groups, anti-trans groups, have been advocating to make exemptions for people to practice conversion practices on trans people. So just banning conversion therapy for cis queer people, so gay men and lesbian women and bisexual people. Another consequence is that religious groups have been quite vocal that they want a right to continue practicing conversion therapy as their religious freedom. So these are the things that could happen, is that there could be so many exemptions in this bill for parents, for religious people, for people to practice on trans people, that this bill will become ineffective and it actually does not protect anyone.
Yeah, and I guess that for people who are allies or parents who might not have directly experienced the effects of conversion therapy or seen it happen to someone that they love, what would kind of be your advice to them to show their support through this process?
The first thing that I would say is that we've written quite detailed templates for people to use. So if parents and allies, and even if queer people do not know where to get started on this, they can absolutely come to our Instagram, which is @convergenttherapynz, and they can use our templates. If they don't want to use our templates, they can use it as something that can prompt them to write their own submissions. However, I would say that everyone needs to recognize that queer people are family. So even if you think you don't know a queer person in your family, you can never tell, because have you made it safe enough for the queer people in your life to come out to you? So when you do these little things, that you show the people around you that you care about them by making a submission to end conversion therapy, you're becoming a safer person to come out to. You're creating a safer environment for queer people to exist in.
And based on the support you've seen, are you hopeful that we will be able to get more submissions for banning conversion therapy rather than against?
Absolutely. I think there is a very good potential here. We've got a lot of potential in our community to make those submissions. What I do know is that the templates that I've put out there have already had 30,000 clicks, which means that people have clicked on those links 30,000 times. Now, if a small proportion of those people make submissions, say 3,000 of them make submissions, we still have a very significant number of submissions. Ultimately, what people need to recognize is that we only have 10 days left, And so there's no time for us to procrastinate. We are in lockdown, and I understand that not everybody has the mental energy or mental capacity to keep going. But I can assure you that if you use our templates, it has all the instructions, all the things written out for you. It takes you less than 5 minutes to complete the whole process.
That was Chanel Lal from Conversion Therapy Action Group speaking to Jessica about how people can make a submission to ban harmful conversion therapy practices. Now, Sarah's just shown me that Chanel's actually tweeted saying that they think that we've just about broken the submission website. There's been a lot of support of this on social media, particularly if you've been looking through your stories, as I know people have been, because you've been staring at your screen being in lockdown. But anyway, you're tuned into the Monday Wire on 95BFM. My name is Jemima. It's lockdown, so I've got the desk today for Jessica and Louie, but we'll be right back after a short little break. Send me through a text. 5395 is the number.
Southbound Records, New Zealand's largest range of new vinyl, a fantastic curated selection of secondhand, plus all the accessories you need. Brushes, cleaners, sleeves, crates and more. Their in-store experts can help you out whatever genre you're into. So support your local and head into Southbound today. Southbound Records, your vinyl specialists. Pop in at 132 Simon Street or order online.
Normally bubbles and whiskey don't mix, but this year things are a little different. Have some award-winning Thompson whiskey delivered direct to Dad's bubble this Father's Day, why don't you? What kind of dad is he? Smooth, smoky, fruity? Hey, you don't have to say a thing. Thompson Whiskey New Zealand, available for safe home delivery now from the Halitau web store or quality online stockists. ThompsonWhiskey.com.
Science is all around us. This rock. That's science. Sandals, that's science too. My wife calling me to tell me to pick up some milk. You'd never know it, but that's science too. Impressive stuff, but where do we go to find out about more science? Sarah?
Dear Science, join Francis Wright every week as he speaks to a rotating roster of boffins and brainiacs, chatting about discoveries, controversies, and general scientific wonder. Dear Science, every Wednesday wire on 95BFM. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
The Wire.
Their relationships with their girlfriends or their wife. They shouldn't have more than one wife at a time.
You're back on The Wire on 95BFM. On the 12th of August, Mandy Hager released her new book about Aotearoa's history of protest. Titled Protest, Shaping Aotearoa, it focuses on notable social justice, human rights and environmental movements from our history. This includes parihaka, employment strikes, women's suffrage and conscientious objection. Louis spoke to the author, Mandy Hager, about the book, how the protest has shaped Aotearoa today, and the similarities between different movements. To start, Louis asked Mandy to explain what the book was about for those who have not seen it.
So it's looking at different protests that have taken place, starting with Hone Heke and chopping down the British flag, right through to... the very latest climate protests going on, the student climate protests, and kind of broken into land protests, employment protests, gender and disability rights, peace issues, racism, protecting the environment and climate action. And then at the end, there's some examples from protests in different Pacific countries, so Samoa, Solomon Islands, Tonga and Kiribati.
Obviously, I guess these protests have taken place over a long time with lots of different circumstances, similarities and parallels that you can draw between each movement.
Yeah, I thought about that quite a lot. One of the really interesting things is that a lot of them were started or led by young people, which I think is really interesting and cool. Once they have become involved in actions, tend to stay active and stay politically engaged. Also, just this thing of ordinary people doing extraordinary things, and that it can start with one person, but once a movement gets rolling, a lot of these protests have made really amazingly positive contributions to the country and things that have really improved the rights of people all over the place. So I've only chosen ones that I actually see as having made a positive difference for the country. Of course, you know, there are all sorts of protests for all sorts of reasons, but I focused on social justice, environment and human rights. So I kind of think that all those people were heroes in a way that had done those things. Incredibly brave from, you know, risking their lives or some of them dying through to tying themselves to railway tracks and all sorts of things.
How come social justice, human rights and the environment were the three subcategories that you chose?
Because to me, they're the ones that have most benefited every person in the country. So I've looked at the ones that have really made a difference to the most people, and they kind of build. So for instance, if you take something like women's vote, that once women got the vote, then the next campaign had to be to actually get women into parliament. And then once women were in parliament, to actually start advocating for laws that would benefit women, like, you know, being able to get a divorce and being supported. And that then leads on to gay rights, which also supported disability rights. So it's kind of like a continuum that once you start trying to improve people's rights, when you've got that one kind of ticked off, then you move on to the next one.
The similarities between different movements, I guess that's something I found quite interesting. And obviously there's links between, you mentioned, a suffragette and then later disability movements and everything in between. But for, for things that occurred, I guess, similar time periods, are there similarities between them? So things like the land reform and then suffragette.
Yeah. Well, I think that we had this amazing example very early on with Parihaka of non-violent resistance, which actually was then used as a model for people like Gandhi and Martin Luther King. I think that that is something that we have in common. We have had, you know, violent resistance, particularly around the employment issues like the Waihi miners' strike and the 1951 waterfront dispute and the Springbok tour. So we have had times where it has kind of fallen to pieces and turned to violence. But overall, most of our protest has been pretty creative, actually.
Obviously, we're talking a little bit about culture now, but not so much about, I guess, the actual results of the protest, which are somewhat more obvious. But how has Aotearoa's history of protest shaped our culture and shaped what we see in civil society today?
Well, because I think it's challenged things. If you take something like the Springbok tour, some of the groups in there, like Ngā Tamatoa and Accord and groups around the Dawn Raid, they all said, you know, we're protesting this stuff that's overseas, but it's time that we turned around and looked at ourselves. Although that was what the Springbok Tour was about, it actually started people thinking about the fact that there was a lot of racism going on here. So sometimes, you know, looking into an issue deeply reflects back the things that we need to change, I think. So it becomes a very kind of forward-looking process, but you start fighting one thing, but then you see, well, we've done this, we now need to move on to the next one. So it is a real continuum.
For you researching this book, were there any things you found in the process that were somewhat surprising? Or
lots and lots of little things, because particularly with the protests that I've personally been involved in over the years, the level of surveillance that went on is one of the things that really shocked me. In the way that the governments lied at times, local bodies too, changed laws and bylaws in order to support business that worked against ordinary people's interests. Overall, the main thing I personally got out of it was a real sense of hope, to be honest. I started writing it during the last lockdown, and I was feeling quite glum about the world and thinking about, you know, climate change. But actually looking at the history and seeing the amount of times that protest actually did make change, I found really cheering and really kind of hopeful for the young people who are now having to face climate change.
Yeah, and that's something, the present day protests, that's something I wanted to touch on. How, I guess, do these protests of Aotearoa's past relate to present movements such as Putaki Bay and climate strike?
A, because I think we have that history of non-violent resistance, so we can use that as a roadmap. So we can look at what other people have done and build on those strategies and see that there are all sorts of different strategies that people have used, you know, from people dressing up and making big puppets and doing kind of creative things through to Polynesian Panthers going and doing dawn raids on politicians to show them what it felt like. So I think that protesters today can see that there are a range of ways that you can make your voices heard and make a difference that don't require turning to violence.
Because the book is obviously targeted towards young adults. For them, I guess, when things aren't going right, when protests feel like they're not moving forward, why is it important to look back on what we've done and to understand our history in terms of protest?
I think so that you don't feel powerless. Young people today are facing a cataclysmic emergency of the climate, and it is really, really easy to feel hopeless. And so I think any way that they can see that change can be made and that, you know, protest can be a noble act, because protesters often get really badly labelled, you know, for what they're doing. But that gives them the encouragement to keep going, and I think they really need that.
That was Mandy Hager speaking to Louie about her new book, Protest Shaping Aotearoa. You can pick up her book for around $40 from most booksellers around the country. We've got another piece now from Louie, where about Maui and Hector dolphins. There are only 54 Maui dolphins left, according to the most recent population estimates. Maui dolphins are a subspecies of the more common Hector's dolphin and can be found off the west coast of the North Island. The main pressures on the population include indiscriminate fishing practices like gill netting and trawling, as well as diseases like toxoplasmosis. Louie was joined by University of Otago's Elizabeth Slootin, who is a professor in zoology and has researched Maui and Hector's dolphins for over 3 decades. They talked about the threats to the species, where pressure is coming from, and what changes are needed. He began by asking what their current status was.
Hector's and Maui dolphins have both declined a lot in the last 20, 30 years due to bycatch and fishing nets. So Hector's dolphins are somewhere around a third of their original population size, and Maui dolphins are well below 10% of their original population size. So it's just devastating to hear that that Maui dolphin population has declined even further.
What are the threats to their population sizes?
The main threat is fishing, and really only two fishing methods. So it's gill nets and trawling that are quite indiscriminate also when you think about what fish they are catching as well. So these two fishing methods both use nets. They catch a wide variety of different species. So there isn't even anything that you would identify that this is the target fish species. And then in addition to that, they catch a range of seabirds, marine mammals, and often sharks as well.
Are there things in place to reduce the impact that they have and the harm they have on Maui and Hector's dolphins?
Yes. So the main management method is to have no gill nets and trawling used in certain areas. And so that started in 1988 with just one small protected area around Banks Peninsula. And from about 2008, there has been some protection in most areas where Hector's and Maui dolphins are found, and another extension of those last year in 2020.
So why then? Because Maui dolphins I've seen have dropped now to 54. Why are we still seeing this decrease in population?
Basically because these protected areas are far too small. So the international science community have been recommending to New Zealand that they should protect Hector's and Maui dolphins throughout their habitat from those two fishing methods, from gill nets and trawling. So the IUCN and the International Whaling Commission have both been recommending since 2012 that New Zealand should be doing that, banning gill nets and trawling out to 100 metres water depth in the case of the IUCN and 20 nautical miles in the case of the International Whaling Commission.
So given that these restrictions haven't been put in place yet, is there, because I know fisheries is a big industry, it contributes a lot to the New Zealand economy, is there substantial pressure from the fishing community and industry?
Yeah, that's for sure. There's been consistent pressure from both commercial and recreational fishers at times, but recently mostly from the commercial fishing industry, very consistent pressure. So most of the time when a protection measure has been put in place for these dolphins, then almost every time the fishing industry takes the government to court over these. And this last time in 2020, they did not do so, but they said that they wanted the snapper quota on the west coast of the North Island increased. And so recently the Ministry for Primary Industries announced that they wanted to almost double the snapper quota on the West Coast North Island. And most of that fish is caught using gill nets and trawling, so that would increase the pressure. So now that we know that the Maori dolphin population is still declining, that absolutely can't happen now. We can no longer afford to ignore those dolphin deaths and fishing nets. And that includes following the advice of the IUCN and the International Whaling Commission.
One of the other threats that I've seen mentioned a lot is toxoplasmosis. How much of an impact does this have? Is that still something that would reduce population sizes, even if we reduced trawling and gill nets?
That whole area of toxoplasmosis is very poorly known. Right now, it's based on a very small sample of dead dolphins found on beaches. So right at the moment, really, that looks like a red herring that is a kind of a scapegoat that you could waste an awful lot of time on first doing research to find out if it actually is an important threat. And then secondly, we have no idea what you might do about toxoplasma or other diseases. Whereas with fishing, it's very easy to find out how many dolphins are being caught, and it's very easy to avoid catching them.
For the people who aren't aware of the population levels and the risks for Mauis and Hector's dolphins, what would you tell them to be like, look, these species are very important and they're things that are special to New Zealand?
Well, aside from being special to New Zealand and only found here, these numbers are just devastating. So Maui dolphin was already listed as critically endangered. And so to see them decline even further, they are literally teetering on the edge of extinction. So we've seen what happens when dolphins' populations are dropped below 50 individuals. The vaquita, which is a Mexican harbour porpoise, also when it reached about 50 individuals, it dropped really precipitously down to, they think now, 10 or 20 individuals. So 50 individuals is really, you don't want to go anywhere near that. We need to rebuild to several hundred dolphins before we'd be even remotely safe with these dolphins.
So given that obviously you mentioned once species drop below 50, there's risks for extinction. Given that the Maui's dolphin population is at 54 now, do you still have faith that their population size can recover?
We really need to pull everything out of the bag right now. There's actually an IUCN conference starting on Friday. Basically, the government can no longer ignore that advice from this large international body that deals with conservation. We really need to ban those gill nets and trawling in Hector's and Maui dolphin habitat. And in the case of Maui dolphin, we need to do it yesterday. We really don't have any time left to do anything. Luckily, there is no indication of inbreeding yet, but we will be starting to enter that sort of, you know, extinction vortex where there's basically no turning back.
That was University of Otago's Elizabeth Slootin. Next, Louis spoke to Sea Shepherd's Michael Laurie. Sea Shepherd is an international non-profit focused on the protection and conservation of marine species. Louis and Michael talked about the action his organisation was taking to save the species and the backlash they had faced. To start, Louis asked him what Sea Shepherd's demands were.
It's pretty much what local and international scientists, including the IWC, IUCN, have been asking for almost 10 years now, I think, maybe 2012, which is basically to protect them in their entire habitat range. And that's the issue. They're not being protected out to the 100-metre depth contour. They're being protected in a sort of a strip along the coast that's not really their entire habitat, and that's the issue. So a good sign. So we would like the government and the government agencies to implement what the good science is, and that's to protect them in their full range. But obviously they don't want to because it's economic interests.
Yeah, because Sea Shepherd, I understand, is an international organisation. How do you guys look to take action against the fishing companies and to look to say to government, look, we need these changes made now?
Well, that's why we have this US court case, because obviously we can't stop them physically with direct action like we have done in some places in the world, like in the Southern Ocean where it's international waters. All we can really do in New Zealand is observe them. We're not really very good at lobbying governments. It's not really our Sea Shepherd specialty area. We don't really do many petitions. I don't know how many Maui dolphin petitions there have been, but there's been a lot of them and they haven't really had any effect at all. Well, Sea Shepherd Legal in the state, they come up with this idea about pressuring the US government around their new marine mammal protection laws. And they've got this pretty robust Marine Mammal Protection Act that's coming into full force, and it's reasonably complicated. It's coming to full force in 2022. But critically endangered marine mammals like Maui or the vaquita in Mexico have that coverage, that full force of the regulation now.
Yeah, the lawsuit was something I found quite interesting, because it seems like an unusual route to take rather than what you've mentioned, petitions and stuff. Do you know why this route was taken, why you guys decided to go for a lawsuit as your means?
Firstly, we asked the American government, this International Court of Justice, to implement the ban, because according to their regulations, we didn't think the fish exports from Maui habitat were compliant with US regulations. So our argument is they are not compliant. And there's also a precedent for the case in that vaquita dolphin has gone down the same route. So about three NGOs did the same thing, pretty much the same court action with the vaquita porpoise, and they won the case. And NOAA, which is effectively their version of MPI, tried to fight it, like they tried to fight this one, and they lost. I think they even lost an appeal as well. So exports of fish from vaquita porpoise area in the Gulf of California are banned going into the States. It's the same. So we're using the same legal angle. And the reason why we went that way is because we can pretty much pressure the New Zealand government and the agencies, and also it's independently assessed, so the fishing companies in New Zealand can't spin on it, but they haven't got any say, it's in someone else's jurisdiction.
The lawsuit, what consequences would this have on New Zealand's fishing industry?
Well, that's the thing. Yeah, a good point actually, because it might not have, it's a bad look for their brand, really the major thing. It looks bad for their brand, because if you go to all the fishing companies websites in New Zealand, like Sanford, Tellys, Sea Lord, They all pimp out New Zealand as being a sustainable green haven. You know, it's all wild caught fish and we're in this beautiful pristine environment. So that's it's a brand damage to their brand, because it's not sustainable. And our marine mammals are under threat, not just Maui, but also lots of other things like our sharks, our seabirds, our penguins, our sea lions. The list goes on and on. We've got a massive fishing industry and we've got very few people. Most of our exports, 93% of our seafood is exported, you know. So what they could do, if the ban did come into place, and I think there's a good chance, you know, they could just sell the fish elsewhere. You know, that's all they could do. They could sell more to, you know, I think snapper, most of it goes to Australia, China. They could just up that. But it's going to be annoying. It's going to make their brand look pretty crappy. And maybe it's going to, hopefully going to highlight to other countries like Australia, for example, who are one of our biggest customers as far as the seafood goes. Maybe they're going to start thinking, well, you know, do our customers really want to eat snapper from Maui habitat?
I mean, has there been any, because obviously the action was taken in July last year, I believe. Has there been any success since then? Has there been any moves from the New Zealand or American government?
There's been a lot of toing and froing. It's been going on for almost 2 years. So we presented the petition, they said no. And then I think we did an interim injunction and they said no again. And now it's gone to the court. We presented all that evidence, and then the New Zealand government and NOAA presented their evidence. And now there's been the last part of it was a verbal submission. They verbally had to sort of represent the case or in front of the judge. And that happened about 6 weeks ago. That's the last part of the whole case. And now we're waiting on the judge to make his decision.
One of the things that Liz Sluton mentioned when I talked to her, she said that once dolphin and whale populations hit 50 or below, it's almost an inevitable spiral towards extinction.
Oh, really?
And given that Maui dolphin are at 54 right now, do you think that possibly lawsuits are too strenuous and long process to save the species?
Yeah, it has taken 2 years. I think it's probably quicker than petitions. because, I mean, people have been trying to lobby the government for years. I mean, going back to where they started making law changes in about 2008, this has been going on to try and save these dolphins for a long time. It was probably one of the only angles left that we could really come up with, the only strategy, because there's not a lot else we can really do.
Because one of the things you did mention was that the lawsuits is almost like your last course of action. But are there any things that you any other things that you have considered that you guys are looking towards doing in the future if this law doesn't work?
Well, I think what we're doing at the moment, we're getting a vessel that's going to be dedicated to going out on the West Coast for the Maui dolphin. We've had someone that's offered to buy half the vessel for us. It's like a sort of 6-7 metre aluminium power boat, but it will be we'll use for sort of monitoring the Maui habitat and also used for monitoring fishing boats. Because they're protected in, like I mentioned before, in a very artificial, almost like a reservation type strip, coastal strip out to 4 nautical miles. But obviously the dolphins don't know if they go outside the area. And we do know that the trawlers go right up against it. So they are certainly in danger of from trawlers.
Yeah, because Liz Slootin obviously mentioned that there's a lot of backlash from the fishing industry. But from the people you've talked to and fishermen that you've chatted with, I guess, has there been any people who are like, yeah, look, we really want these restrictions to come into place and we'll do things to support you guys?
No, I've never had that from any fishing people at all. Obviously, the recreational fishing people like Legacy, they're supportive, but not the commercial people. No, there's too much money involved in it for them.
That was Sea Shepherd's Michael Laurie speaking about Maui and Hector's dolphins.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
You are on The Wire on 95BFM. We have another couple of pieces for you before we round out the show today. A blob of warm water off the east coast of Aotearoa is causing drought in South America, according to recent research. The blob emerged naturally in the 1980s, but its temperatures have considerably increased with global warming. Louis talked to Dr. Kyle Clem, who is a professor in climate at the Victoria University of Wellington, and one of the report's authors, about the blob's causes and impacts. To start, Louis asked Dr. Clem to explain what the blob actually was.
So the southern blob is a big pool of warm water off the east coast of New Zealand that's been warming steadily over the past 40 years. And it's warmed 1.5 degrees Celsius over the past 40 years. And it occupies an area of about 8 million square kilometers, which is about the size of Australia. It's warming 3 times faster than the global average sea surface temperature warming over that same 40-year period. What this area of ocean warming is doing is it builds a strong ridge of high pressure. So these areas are big, expansive regions of warm, dry, stable conditions, these ridges of high pressure. So the blob is building a ridge of high pressure across the South Pacific that extends from New Zealand to the west coast of South America. And that is most marked during the winter season. And this is when the west coast of Central South America depend on their rainfall for really the year. So they have a winter wet season and a summer dry season. And so during the winter, the blob is building this ridge of high pressure that's blocking storm systems that normally deliver their rainfall during winter from reaching them, and it's shifting them southward toward Antarctica.
Just again, for a bit of context for those who don't know, would you be able to just explain how sea temperatures and sea conditions impact climatic conditions?
So in this case, the blob is warming the atmosphere, and it's causing it to expand and just build this ridge of high pressure. So that's what, in this case, what we're doing is seeing warming through the atmosphere from the blob that gets propagated down across the South Pacific.
And so obviously you've said it's blocking rainfalls in South America, but are there any extra consequences that could arise because of that are arising?
Yes, so it's steering more stronger storm systems toward West Antarctica and the Antarctic Peninsula, which is contributing to warming on the Antarctic Peninsula and loss of sea ice there during winter.
And I guess back to Chile again, I've seen that it's currently experiencing a record-breaking drought with, I think, a station in Santiago, which is the capital, recording only 78 mils of rain this year. Could you just elaborate on the consequences for Chile and the rest of South America?
Central Chile has been drying over this whole 40-year period, but since about 2010, they've seen an unprecedented drought where they've just seen year after year of uninterrupted below normal rainfall that ranged from 20 to 80% below normal for the winter season for the whole year since 2010. And our study ended in 2018, but the drought has continued up until present, and this year is looking like another drought year there. And so this is dwindling the freshwater resources that they depend on. So it's dwindling snowpack in the Andes that help to generate hydropower and just freshwater for drinking or all purposes.
I've seen that you've said before that there's part of the causes to this have been natural variability and reduced rainfall, but obviously you've said that it's become much more extreme in recent years, the temperatures.
Yes, so we used climate models without anthropogenic greenhouse gases to see if the blob can emerge from natural processes alone. And what we found is that it can. And this is likely what initiated the blob earlier in this 40-year period, back in the 1980s, was we've seen a decline in rainfall in the central tropical Pacific. And this is similar to La Nina conditions. And what that has been doing is changing the local winds off the east coast of New Zealand that favor warmer water to be transported into the blob, and also reduces the upwelling of colder water from depth. So this is likely the natural origin that started the blob, but it's persisted for 40 years now. That's where the anthropogenic component amplifies the rate of warming. And so our climate models, we use 52 of them. On average, without anthropogenic greenhouse gases, you only get a rate of warming over a 40-year period. The highest you can get is about a half a degree Celsius over 40 years. And we've seen 1.5 degrees Celsius. And so that means that while the blob may be of natural origin, increases in greenhouse gases have added heat to it to result in this remarkable rate of warming, perhaps up to 2/3 of the observed warming. So, and that's what's caused the ridge to be so strong. And that's why this drought in central Chile is unprecedented, and we've never seen it in the...
Yeah, so I guess as temperatures begin to rise and as climate change doesn't really seem to be stopping, how extreme do you expect conditions in Chile to get? Are there models that you've ran to predict this?
Well, so that touches on the question of when will blob dissipate. Right now, we just don't know. And that's the next area of research that we're going to look into. We have an understanding of how much added heat has come from anthropogenic greenhouse gases from climate change. But we don't know how this massive amount of accumulated heat in the blob will dissipate in the future, even if things return back to normal in the central tropical Pacific. This natural mechanism that likely started it. If things reverse up there, you would expect the blob to dissipate, but we've accumulated so much heat from the combination of natural and anthropogenic forcing that we just don't know how long it's going to take for that heat to subside. That means until that dissipates, the drought in Chile will likely continue.
I guess from what you've been saying, it seems like this is a pretty novel circumstance, something that hasn't been seen a lot before. Are there any examples from around the world, from other oceans and other areas that you've used in your research to draw upon and explain what's happening?
So this is the first multi-decadal warming that's been linked to altering the atmospheric circulation across a vast portion of a whole hemisphere, of the southern hemisphere. And so what we've found is quite novel. And it shows that these big patches of warming, if they're sustained, they can lead to sustained climatic conditions that change. You know, there's more storms off the coast of West Antarctica now, and then there's less in central Chile.
That was Dr. Kyle Clem from Victoria University of Wellington talking about how a patch of warm water off the east coast of New Zealand is impacting South American weather. You're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM. I'm Jemima and I'm looking after the show today for Jessica and Louis. If you want to send through a text, the number is 5395. Let us know what you think of the pieces on the show today and we'll be right back with one more after this.
Are you aged 30 or over? It's your time to get vaccinated. If you're 30 plus, you can reserve your spot for the COVID-19 vaccination now. Remember, there's no cutoff point, so you can book at any time. It's also completely free. Find a vaccination clinic near you and book today. Go to bookmyvaccine.nz to reserve your spot now. The stronger our immunity, the greater our possibilities.
Oh, I wake up in the morning. It's already on my mind. If I don't have it, I don't function. You feel it in your stomach, you know. I guess some people don't even think about it, but for me, it'll always be the most important meal of the day.
Breakfast food on 95BFM. Your weekly helping of what's good in recipes, seasonal produce and general deliciousness. Every Thursday after 8 on 95BFM Breakfast, thanks to Foodprint, the only food ordering app you need.
At this radio station, we do our utmost to abide by the Broadcasting Standards Authority and their rules and guidelines. If you seriously think we've crossed the line on air, give us a call on 309 4831 within 20 working days of the broadcast date and tell us about it. We'll be able to help you out and tell you the procedure if you wish to make a formal complaint to the Broadcasting Standards Authority. Fuck knuckles, cock and piss. Balls. Thank you.
The Wire. Sitting on the beach watching transnational criminal scum neoliberal filth.
You're on The Wire on 95BFM. A new University of Otago study has reported on the experiences of people working from home during the second national lockdown. While the shift to working from home has overall become easier, some people are not coping as well as others due to factors such as combining childcare with remote work and managing work-life balance. Jessica spoke to Dr. Paula O'Kane from the Otago University Business School on how employers can best support their employees during this time.
All right, so first of all, can you just tell our listeners a little bit about your survey and what you were looking for there?
So this was just a very brief survey that was looking at the adjustment to remote working during this lockdown. So we have done a bigger survey during the 2020 lockdown, and we had planned to do another survey to follow up on that one, but we felt it wasn't the right time to do it. So this is a very brief 5-question pulse survey, which just asks people about their experiences during this lockdown.
From this little survey, which gained responses from 2,000 people, I think you said, you saw that some people weren't coping as well as others. Can you tell me a little bit about why this might be?
Yeah, so what we see is whenever we sort of look at the headline figures, they sort of look perhaps a little bit rosier than whenever we look below the surface and we look at some of the comments that people have made. And when we go through those, it shows us that with definitely a lot of struggles with the balance of childcare in particular. I would say, you know, 200 to 300 of the 1,000 comments that people made were around how difficult it was to balance looking after children. So that's quite difficult or different in a lockdown scenario to what it is to a normal remote working scenario. We also see people getting worried about social isolation. So those comments are coming through as well, where that connectivity that they have in work with other people, there's a lot of people missing that. And you see that more with the people who don't have family or people living with them. We also still see issues around connectivity with our Wi-Fi, with the equipment that people have, not enabling them to do their job as well as they would like to.
Another issue the survey kind of talked about was lack of motivation and productivity. But however, people seem to be quite positive about their productivity and wanting to get work done. So what is kind of an issue here that might be preventing people from working as efficiently as they would be in the office?
So the key thing in this lockdown scenario is the caring responsibilities. That's coming through really strongly. So, and also this isn't a normal response to remote working. So normally we would be a lot more set up for it. I think the uncertainty behind it as well. So how long it's going to last, you know, we're getting updates every week or every few days about how much longer we're going to be in lockdown. Whereas previously, certainly in the first national lockdown, and we had that certainty of a fixed period of time. So I think that uncertainty has increased that demotivation in terms of being able to get started and get set up properly, and perhaps readjust your way of thinking and how you do things when working from home.
Does it seem like that having the previous lockdowns, that organisations and staff have learned from this a little bit, kind of a bit more prepared this time around, or was this time a little bit different?
So yes and no. So definitely there's a lot of evidence to say that organisations and individuals were prepared. So whether it was organisations had supplied a lot more equipment during the year or so since the last national lockdown, or even people setting up their own equipment at home. But on the other hand, that very quick move to lockdown, just those few hours notice, really impacted what people were able to bring from their offices. So I remember at the last lockdown, we had people carting lots of things out of their offices, and they had a couple of days to really think about what they needed. And this time it was only a few hours. A lot of people may not even have gone into the office in that time. So I think that's the sort of, yes, they were more prepared on one level, but the quick lockdown actually made people less prepared on another level.
And reading through the respondents' submissions, did you see any of your own experiences reflected in there?
Absolutely. I mean, I have two children. At the moment, it's not too bad because my husband isn't working, but he goes back to work on Wednesday, and that changes my dynamic quite a lot. In terms of connection, I mean, I'm pretty much enjoy connecting with people. So I do a lot of Zoom catch-ups, but you can see that some people find that too much. Other people really enjoy it, but don't get enough of it. So we've got quite individuality in there. And so for organisations, that's a real balance to try and make sure that they provide options for people, but don't necessarily force things onto people. So give them flexibility in that communication with others.
And how can employers go about then best supporting their staff? What are some of the key, I know you've mentioned flexibility, but some of the key things that maybe employers should keep in mind when it comes to productivity and work efficiency?
So I think the first thing, and a lot of people sort of noted this as well, this is not normal work. This is not work as we know it. And so I think what we've got to think about is prioritising the work that needs done, and perhaps thinking about what things we can put off until we're in a more stable situation out of lockdown. In terms of thinking about people's mental health, a lot of that's got to do with good communication. So really giving people timely information, not too much information, but enough to enable them to know what the expectations are of them. So what is it that you should be achieving? And again, that flexibility, you can see a lot of organisations are pretty flexible with people, but there's certainly a lot of comments in there that sort of reflect that the organisations aren't really taking into account some of the mental health issues around social isolation and expecting people to work normal hours whenever it's not necessarily possible to work normal hours. So there's sort of mixed responses, and we're really keen to make sure that we give voice to those responses that show a lot of concerns that people have as well.
And has there been any insight from the survey or from previous surveys that you've done about people's preferences now changing from working in an office to working remotely or doing a bit of both? Is this something we can expect that employers will need to negotiate with their employees in the future?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it really strongly comes through to us that flexible working, so not just remote working, but flexible working is really, really important as we move forward within New Zealand. It's really important on lots of levels around work-life balance, around the environment, so sort of creating less commute for people, giving people options about where they might live, how they might interact with people, building up communities if people are working a little bit more from home. So I really strongly feel that in New Zealand we really need to think very strongly about even at a national, or sorry, at a government level, thinking about putting into place working from home policies and ways that we should operate to enable people to request a lot more remote and flexible working.
And that was all the questions that I had, but I think if people wanted to share their insights, they can still do this. That's correct?
Yeah. Yes, the survey is still available. Yep. So it's at bit.ly/NZ remote work.
That was Dr. Paula O'Kane from the University of Otago's Business School reporting on the experiences of remote workers during lockdown.
That was The Wire.
Ko editor Hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki. That brings us to the end of the show, the Monday Wire, for another week. Thank you very much to you for tuning in and listening to the show today. Really appreciate your calls and your texts. I know it's sort of a funny time out there, so it's really good to hear that people are enjoying the show and are listening, so thank you so much. Huge thank you to the people who spoke with Louie and Jessica today: Chanel Lal, Mandy Hager, Professor Elizabeth Sluton, Michael Laurie, Dr. Kyle Clem, and Dr. Paula O'Kane. Appreciate hugely the time our experts and our interviewees give us when we speak to them for these interviews, particularly at the time, because it's a stressful time out there. And massive thank you to Jess and Louie for producing yet another awesome lockdown show. It is such a feat to produce a show from home and get all your pieces sounding pretty good and nice and ready to go to radio at 11:30. So thank you so much for that. We'll be back with some more Wires for the rest of the week for you. So if you're interested in current affairs and news, stay tuned at midday to 1, because that's when we bring you the latest. But yeah, stay tuned to 95BFM. I hope you're good out there. I hope you're keeping safe and well. And we'll catch you next time.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.